In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. Yesterday, a new period drama dropped on Sky Atlantic and HBO. Called Mary and George, it transports viewers back to the intrigues and scandals of the court of King James VI and I. Benjamin Woolley wrote the book on which the new show is based and also acted as its historical advisor. In today's episode, he joins us to discuss the challenges of depicting King James's relationships with his favourites for a 21st century audience, and reveals what we know about the real figures depicted on screen. He was speaking to Eleanor Evans.
We are talking today about a new Sky original series, Mary and George, which is inspired by a true story based on your book, The King's Assassin. Benjamin, can you introduce us to Mary and George and how it feels to be seeing their stories and your work coming to life on the screen?
If I may, I'd sort of like to backtrack a little bit to where I encountered the story of Mary and George, because it was a really odd way into this story in many respects. So I was writing a book about somebody called Nicholas Culpepper, who was this sort of Civil War era, English Civil War era radical, who worked in London as an unlicensed apothecary. And Culpepper had a falling out with the College of Physicians. And as part of my researches, I was looking at the College of Physicians and the role of particularly of Dr. William Harvey, who's a big figure in the history of medical science, his role in King James's final illness. And in the Chamber of Sorrows, as it was called, that is, James's sick room, these two characters, Mary and George, who seemed to be coordinating what was going on in James's final hours. So I saw these characters basically at the king's bedside, and I just wondered, who are they? And that is where my introduction to Mary and George came from. And the more I found out about them, the more I saw an opportunity for a book. George attracted my attention because he's a very prominent historical figure, but hardly anyone knows about him or has heard of him. But his mother started to become a much more prominent part of the story when I started to research it, because she came from a relatively lowly family, but claimed descent. She would later claim descent of five European kings. So how did she end up at James I's bedside was the question that I was asking myself. And the more I explored it, the more extraordinary the story became, particularly, obviously, when the relationship between George Villiers and James started to sort of emerge from the research that I was doing. It was an amazing relationship, and there was a fantastic collection of letters which captured a lot of that relationship, and that's something that's fairly unusual to the point of almost being unique in that period of history.
Well, this is a great introduction, and let's go back to the start of this story then, if we can. So Mary is not from modest beginnings, but she's very far from court. Can we talk about her rise and her ambitions for this favoured son as well, her relationship with George in those earliest years?
Yes, that's a really good way of putting it. She was miles from court. She was miles geographically, but also in terms of social status from court. The idea that she would find herself inside it, in the king's inner circle, would have been inconceivable when she started out. I mean, she was a waiting woman to one of her relatives, basically, as a teenager in Leicestershire. Her background was one that meant that she had a fairly ambiguous social status. In fact, the role of waiting women at this time is a really odd one to modern ears because, for example, Amelia in Othello, if people know the Shakespearean play Othello, she's a waiting woman to Desdemona, who's one of the main characters. And they are both sort of servants, but also confidants. So they're sort of between service, if you like, and gentry. So she occupied this rather ambiguous social ranking. And then she met George Villiers, so the father of my George, if I can call him that. During this early modern period, people keep using the same names over and over again. It's an absolute nightmare from the point of view of research. But anyway, so George Senior, if we can call him that, was an MP. Obviously, he was highly ambitious and he ran up enormous debts after they married very quickly, had children very quickly. George was the second son. And the first son, John, turned out to be, well, just bluntly, a bit of a dud. He didn't look like the kind of figure who could realise any ambitions that this family might have for the Villierses, for the Villiers name. George, on the other hand, was charismatic, good-looking, clever, witty, complicated, not particularly intellectual, but certainly knew how to work a room. So she decided to work with that. Second sons traditionally had a terrible time. In fact, there's a lot of people coming second, as it were, in this story, who somehow come out first. So she's a second wife to George. His first wife had died. George was the second son who would normally expect to inherit nothing because, of course, the eldest son would inherit everything. I mean, Charles the First, who Prince Charles at this point, who was James's son, he was a second son who went on to become first. This sort of group of figures who were seconds, who became first, is quite an interesting dynamic at work here. And George turned out to be a very presentable character. He was sent to France to try and learn the kind of manners that would enhance his charisma and status. And at the time, 1603, James the Sixth of Scotland became James the First of England, an extremely confusing title for many people because he inherited the throne from Elizabeth. And James, being a Scot, started his regime basically surrounded by Scottish hangers-on and those who were considered to be, well, they were described as minions or Ganymedes. And there was a lot of discussion about James's relationship with these young Scottish men. From an English point of view, the real problem was that there were no young English men in James's close retinue, and George was weaponized by Mary in order to fill that gap. And that he did with spectacular success.
Wonderful. So Mary, played by Julianne Moore, we see her making these moves, these machinations in court. Could you take us a little bit closer to this court? You mentioned the makeup of more Scottish courtiers when he comes to the English throne. What's the sort of spirit of the court? What's it like being there?
Well, James's court after Elizabeth well, it would have been a bit of fresh air to some people, but it's very raucous. It was very open in the sense that, you know, there was a lot of display. Elizabeth, being female, it was a much more restrained, courtly environment. When it came to James, it was an entirely different kind of affair. Remember, the court is not a place, it's not a location, it's an institution. It just basically followed James around. And James didn't really like to be tied down to one particular place, not least because of his background. I mean, his father had been murdered. There had been endless attempts to kill him when he was the King of Scotland. He was a nervous person and he liked to move around for that reason, among many others. He also liked to hunt and things like that. And the court would follow him around as he moved around the countryside. And as a result, there was a lot more sort of social interaction with James than there would have been in Elizabeth's time, when there was a much more sort of cordon sanitaire around her. And it was a kind of environment that Mary and George seemed to fit right into. They really thrived in this more social milieu, if you like. And that's what provided them with an opportunity to sort of get close to him and for George to catch James's eye and James ultimately to fall for George. It was leaky in that respect. And that was why it was such a clever operation to, so to speak, plonk George in front of James so he couldn't miss him, which was done at this marvellous mask, which they create in the drama in Hatfield House in this sort of huge barn-like structure next to the main house. And it's I have to say, seeing that, it was such a dazzling event to see it being recreated for this series, Mary and George, and captured so well how I imagined it when I was reading about it and writing about it.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. It's a scene I enjoyed as well. And can we hear a little more about this culture of favourites within James's court? How does George break into this set? What does he find when he becomes part of this intimate court?
So there were lots of rumours about James's sexuality, to use contemporary language. Certainly not how they would have described it at the time. But there was this idea of the minion or Ganymede essentially being having a sexual relationship with the king. I mean, that's not an unfamiliar notion then at all, because, you know, I mean, it goes back to antiquity, doesn't it? I mean, the Greek vases that very clearly show these sorts of activities were something they would have been familiar with in that period. And it was used as a sort of way of criticising, a sort of puritanical criticism of the court was that this was going on. But because he was the king, it couldn't openly be discussed. Certainly couldn't publish things about it. There were these Stuart libels, as they come to be called, these songs and poems that circulated the streets referring to it. And James initially had a very strong relationship with one of his Scottish courtiers. And George's job was to kind of pull James in his direction away from this sort of rival consort, if you like, male consort to James. And it was that rivalry that characterised, that's competition basically, intense competitiveness, that jostling around the king that characterised the court, and that George, well, and Mary were good at manipulating. Mary hasn't been written about much, and trying to find any history of her was really difficult. But the more, basically, that she annoyed people, annoyed the mainly male establishment, but also female establishment of the time, aristocratic establishment, the more there would be these explosions of anger at her, expressed through various letters or diplomatic reports and things like that, that revealed what a clever strategist she was for manipulating the court.
I think that strategy is really interesting. And I think that the power and the politics on screen are pretty ruthless. I mean, I wonder if we can talk more about how widely the king's relationships were known about. I think that's an important thing for the listeners to understand, to know how Mary pushed for her son's inclusion in this world. What was understood or can be known about the real nature of the king's relationship with his favourites, and how much was Mary understanding that?
That's a really good question. And it's hard to know the physical relationships, the physical aspect of the relationships that James had. However, I mean, as somebody who studied English literature and history and the relationship between the two, I particularly enjoyed exploring this because it was a sort of textual analysis that helped one explore what was going on with James. When he was King of Scotland, up in Scotland, he had this relationship with a kinsman, basically, Esme Stuart, who was from France, who was, I mean, old enough to be his father. But he wrote an extraordinary poem talking about a phoenix resting between the thighs of this figure in a way that was highly suggestive. And when it came to the relationship between George and James, there's a collection of letters. It was an American academic called Bergeron who collected them in a volume called King James and the Letters of Homoerotic Desire, which was a bit of a breakthrough book, actually, in terms of, if you like, queer history or however you like to characterise it, because it just, if you read it, it's they're a set of love letters. There are lots of ambiguous, suggestive phrasing in these letters. There's also just very moving parts of some of the letters, such as when James sent us a letter at Christmas time to George after the death of James's Queen Anne, sort of pleading with George to become his wife. And that kind of language clearly shows a very deep, complex, probably sexual relationship between these two. Of course, we don't know the details of what goes on in the chamber, in the not complete privacy, but relative privacy, the intimacy of their relationship in the king's bedchamber. But, I mean, obviously one can speculate about that. The interesting thing about this becoming drama is that speculation isn't quite going to do it. You have to dramatise what's happening. And one of the most fascinating parts of this adventure of being involved in this production was, not just in that respect, actually in so many respects, was how you actually visualise something that you only had to kind of speculate about when you were writing about it historically. So, obviously, how do you show what kind of sex they had and things like that? And we had discussions about this, bizarre, you could say, discussions about it. I had my views on it, others had other views on it, and what you see is what you get, so to speak. The production, you know, really was quite bold in how they interpreted it. I have no problem with that. In fact, the boldness is, in many respects, quite refreshing. There's no sort of Victorian prudery, I can tell you, in this drama. But that's what drama does. Drama, you know, you have to, well, what are we actually looking at here? You know, what are they saying and what are they doing? That's the thing that drama brings to this that nonfiction doesn't.
Yes, I think that's a really interesting point, that it's creating a more obvious line or a take on this relationship, which obviously you can't get away from as a viewer. It's there front and centre. I guess, is there anything else that struck you being involved in this production about those representations of sexuality or, you know, sex on screen, interpreting that for a 21st century audience? What are the challenges there?
Well, there are massive challenges. I mean, the first thing I should say, though, is I set out right at the beginning, I had a very good productive relationship with the production, with Liza Marshall, who produced it and, well, commissioned it, who I first met, who saw the opportunity to make Mary the main story of her drama. And she did a great job of sort of assembling the components that were needed to do that. My attitude to these things was that, you know, this isn't a piece of nonfiction, this is a drama. The most important thing is to tell the story, to dramatise the story. And I said to them quite clearly right from the start, I'm not there to sort of confine the story. I'm not there to sort of pick holes in the story. My contribution is to help inspire the story. And the history provides, if you like, a sort of coherent framework for the story. But then it comes to the point of where the story takes off and moves in its own direction. I mean, they had a role which is relatively new to dramatization of the intimacy coordinator, who was somebody who came in and discussed with the principal actors how they would perform, for example, sex scenes, things like that. And that obviously reflects current values and concerns, as you would expect. So the kind of manoeuvre from my nonfiction contribution and my thoughts about the way the story developed sort of had a momentum that was entirely to do with those kinds of factors, if you like. One of the things that's been fascinating for me about this has been the relationship of nonfiction and drama, or biography as well, which I see myself as primarily a biographer. Nearly every drama you see now begins with some sort of formulation about being a true story or whatever. And the relationship between the two is one that we still puzzle about, don't we, I think. And working on this was a revelation in terms of what happens, what has to happen, what can't happen, what changes are made, what changes aren't made, the relationship of one thing to the other. And one of the things that was distinctive about this production is that I was allowed to be so involved, which was a great privilege because it's a very exciting thing to be involved with for somebody who spends most of his time stuck in his office staring at a screen, but also revealed to me in a way the practical aspects of what's actually involved. And I feel very privileged to have had an insight into that. And I hope that historians will think about it a bit more deeply, as dramatists should too, and what role it plays really in our lives. I mean, the recent dramatization of the post office story only goes to show it can have an absolutely enormous political and social impact when you do this. So working out what that relationship is something that we need to think about a bit more deeply.
I think it's really great insight to have in terms of how a work of historical writing gets turned into a drama, because that those are such big conversations being had around every dramatic production, it seems. But if we can return to Mary and George, you mentioned George caught the king's eye. Can we get a bit of insight into what was it about George and his nature that helped him to become so successful in this world?
So trying to capture George historically was difficult for various reasons, because the sources were either kind of reacting against him or just sucking up to him, basically. It's quite difficult. However, a certain sort of features come through, physical features, a face to paint an angel by, as somebody would later put it, characterising him. He was obviously a beautiful-looking chap. And I have to say, Nick Galitzine, who plays him in Mary and George, fits that to a T, along with many of the other characteristics. I mean, so charisma, people wanted to be with him. They liked him. One of the things about him, even when he was at the height of his powers and he was doing things people got really angry about, he seemed capable of a kind of modesty. He sometimes did get angry himself, but he would react by being quite sort of friendly towards his enemies and sort of de-escalating the issue. He had that characteristic about him. He also was quite fragile. His health was very fragile. His mental health was very fragile. So, I mean, there are various episodes when he's described as having sort of frenzies of the brain that meant that he had to take himself away from court and just disappear for a while. That happened on a few occasions, certainly at various key times of political tension as well. So it might have been related to that. He carried himself well. He could dance like the devil. I mean, that was where James first saw him dancing. And that was one of the ways that people would display their physical prowess, if you like. I mean, he had this very difficult relationship with his mother, very close. I mean, he once described his love for her as going beyond basically natural, but I don't know what he meant by that. I don't think anything too incestuous, if you like, but who knows. But he had a very strong link to her. And of course, the result of that is that when there were tensions between them, they were amplified by it. So the tensions between them were at times close to one of them having to be ruined at the hands of the others. And they just avoided it, only just avoided it. So that essentially is what George was like. And I think it was the combination more than anything that made him such a powerful and appealing character in court.
And the interplay between these two titular characters is obviously so endlessly fascinating. Can we turn to Mary a bit? You mentioned the sources for her are much fewer. How possible is it to surface the real Mary? How much do we know about her?
We don't know a great deal about her. We don't even know when she was born. Conventionally, it's thought to be around 1570, though I think it's possibly 1574, which actually makes a difference because she was much younger when she married George Villiers, obviously, if it was a later date. The date comes from a horoscope that she had drawn up by Richard Napier, a well-known medic and astrologer who she consulted on several occasions. But that's the kind of level of information that one's dealing with, and it's quite difficult at times. One of the breakthroughs for me in research was finding out about the debts that she had to deal with after the death of her husband, which turned out to be astronomical. I mean, her husband, it turned out, had borrowed £30 to buy a coat, which is, you know, that's a year's salary. It's a good salary for that period. But of course, he was doing it for a reason, to try and enhance their status. But she was landed with these debts and she had no way of paying them off except by marrying others. So she ended up in court a couple of times. She ended up in court because the first person she remarried, so to speak, was a wealthy man who fell sick, and she decided she would relieve him of a lot of his property and bring it back to the home that she had shared with George Villiers, things like that. She ended up in London facing the judges for that one. So she pops up in that kind of way, and until she reaches court. And then, of course, she has a lot of enemies who are only too delighted to characterise her. So you have to sort of pick through those and think of, you know, what's motivating what they're writing and what you can get out of it that tells us something about her. So she's a hard one to pin down. Very few portraits of her, although there's some very unflattering ones of her. Well, there's one in particular, a group portrait of her with George and their children. So she's difficult to pin down. One of the things I should also mention is that later she became so powerful, she decided, I'm going to declare myself to be a Roman Catholic. So right in the heart of the Protestant regime that James was trying to stabilise in terms of religion, she decided she would just become a Roman Catholic, and she did so. And James tried to dissuade her, but she wouldn't hear it. That shows the strength of her character. Those are the kinds of things you sort of glimpse through the sources, but she's not somebody who's easy to nail down in terms of historical research, but all the more intriguing for that.
And some listeners will come to her now through Julianne Moore's performance in this programme. So I think that's really brilliant to get more light shone on her. And who knows what we'll find out next?
Well, I do hope so. I hope there's a lot more study into her. And, you know, one can never get to all the sources oneself. So it'd be great to see if new stuff surfaces.
So George has obviously won the contest, as it were, to become a favourite in the king's inner circle. What does this mean for his life, his power? And what does it mean for Mary as well?
So George, by finding himself in this position of the king's favourite, I mean, that's the term, let's use that, meant that he had an extraordinary amount of power and status very, very quickly. I mean, the most obvious example of that was being made duke. So Elizabeth never made anyone a duke. So there wasn't a member of her court who was raised to the rank of duke. That hadn't really been done, I think, for about a century. So there was that. I mean, there were dukes, of course, but they were either, you know, like the Howards, they were dukes that went back to the time of the Normans, or there were members of the royal family, so children and so on. Dukedom, in other words, was normally denoting some direct relationship to the royal family. So he got a dukedom. He also got his mother to be made countess. So that was an extraordinary thing to achieve. So they got rank. He worked through the ranks, you know, he went from Earl, Viscount to Duke and so on. He also engineered with Mary for the marriage of his siblings to suitably high-ranking people. And the lengths Mary went to make sure this happened were extraordinary, recreated in the drama. But there was literally a carriage chase involved in one of the marriages in order to capture the bride. So it went to that extent to try and capture, as it were, this position within the aristocratic establishment. And she achieved that, absolutely achieved that. In terms of other aspects of the power that George could exercise, Mary could not exercise much power, say, political power directly. It all had to be done through George. But he ended up in the Privy Council. He ended up at various points having, you know, control of the Privy Purse, for example, control of the king's finances. He had control over patents, in other words, monopolies that were given to favoured members of the court so they could exercise them, including his own siblings. So Kit, Christopher, his younger brother, ended up with various patents. So he was able to do that. And as he got more and more powerful, he became more and more ambitious. And ultimately, he wanted to change the relationship of the English court. Remember, the Kingdom of England was separate from the Kingdom of Scotland, even though it had the same person on both thrones. But he wanted to change England's foreign policy relationship with Spain. He talked about creating a Northern European Union. He got that ambitious. He was going to change the whole geopolitical arrangement of Europe. Extraordinarily bold. That resulted in him going to war with France, going to war with Spain, and that was ultimately to be his downfall. But the important thing is he managed to even get that far, which was quite a long way along the road of capture, if you like, of the English court, through the very clever relationship he developed with Charles, who was James's heir. Charles, a second son. The first son, Henry, the quintessence of princeliness, unfortunately died when he was in his teens. So Charles, who was the complete opposite, and very clearly so with his weak ankles and so on, Charles came to lean more and more on George as a kind of way of giving himself a sense of his princely worth. And that was how George came to dominate Charles's regime in its early years after the death of James.
Well, you mentioned at the top of the interview that there is obviously this hand possibly in the final days of James VI and First. I wonder if we can turn to that and Charles and George's involvement in that. What did you conclude in your book? Well, how is that playing out on screen? What do we know about it?
Obviously, I don't want to give any spoilers away when it comes to the drama. Well, basically, James died apparently, so goes the official story, he died of malaria. Or he died of a condition that resulted from malaria. I don't think you can die directly from it. But there was a lot of odd things happening in the king's sick room, Chamber of Sorrows, as it was called, when he did die. There were some reports that circulated at the time of James's final illness and soon after that threw questions on what the doctors were up to, because they seemed to be breaking protocol in the way that they were treating James, because malaria was a well-known, it was endemic in England at that time, believe it or not. It was a well-known condition and there were a set of treatments that were well-known. And suddenly something odd happened and it involved some medicine that Mary's apothecary provided in both a form of a paste that was put on a leather plaster and also a posset, a kind of drink that James drank at the time. Right, so lots of theories about what was going on there. After James's death, rumours circulated that he'd been poisoned. Actually, BBC History magazine, I remember, ran a really good article by really the two main historians in this area, Alistair Bellany and Thomas Cogswell, to whom I pay tribute. They're great historians, and he tells the story of this controversy. And what came out of it was ultimately a sensational publication that circulated through Europe, which accused George of poisoning James. There was a lot of politics in that, as you can imagine. But its historical significance is not to be doubted, even though it's dismissed. I think, really, it's been criminally downplayed. We don't know what happened exactly in the King's Bedchamber. What we do know is that during the Civil War, after the arrest of Charles I, when he was essentially defeated, this idea that Charles, who was there at the time, or for some of the time, at the time of his father's death, was involved in it, surfaced rapidly as one of the reasons why Charles should be held to account. So it clearly had a contribution to the sort of political culture of the time. And he wasn't tried on that basis. He wasn't tried for the murder of his father or anything like that. But it certainly fed into the antagonisms that there were between the parliamentarians and the royalists. So it's odd to me that this period of history, the period around George and his rise to the top of the court, is one that's almost completely unknown until, well, I'm hoping that Mary and George might arouse curiosity about it. I hope my book arouses some curiosity about it. I hope the scholarship of Alistair Bellamy and Thomas Cogswell will arouse some interest about it. It just needs to be something that we pay a little bit of attention to. For some reason, the Jacobean period has kind of oddly been written out of history, in my view. I think partly because it's got a weird name. I mean, Jacobean, what's that about? Well, the Latin for James. You know, it's the period of Shakespeare, it's the period when the British Empire started. You know, Jamestown, Virginia, all that stuff, that really started in that period. So I think we need to pay some attention to it.
Yes, it's such a compelling episode, and we will leave our listeners to discover how the show portrays or chooses to portray these really intriguing events. Benjamin, is there anything else you'd like anyone coming to Mary and George for the first time through either your book or the show to understand about these figures from history?
Well, I think I just come to it realising that this was a distinct and important period of history, that, you know, people have heard of Shakespeare. This was when Shakespeare thrived. The culture of England and Scotland were thriving at the time. They were starting to explore new ways of thinking and acting that hadn't been done before, and that it was a time of experimentation, of innovation, and you can see that, as it were, in the kind of stories and dramas that came out of the period.
That was Benjamin Woolley, author of The King's Assassin, The Fatal Affair of George Villiers and James I. Mary and George is airing on Sky Atlantic and Now TV from the 5th of March. You can also find the BBC History Magazine article on the death of King James VI and I that Benjamin mentioned in the interview online for History Extra subscribers at historyextra.com/death-James-VI. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.